First, though, this morning, any moves to make reporting of suspected child abuse mandatory should be treated with caution. This is according to a group that helps train people in how to identify such harm. Earlier this month, ACT leader and Associate Education Minister David Seymour announced changes to the early childhood education sector. He signalled plans to introduce mandatory child abuse reporting, while noting the government had not made a firm decision on it. Well, New Zealand's awful history with child abuse is well documented, with mandatory reporting coming as a recommendation of the 2023 report by Karen Putasi, which was prompted by the death of five-year-old Malachi Subetsk. Now, however, she did note that the report should go hand in hand with regular training for frontline professionals who work with children. Now, my guests this morning are Safeguarding Children CEO Willow Duffy and also Sarah Whitcomb-Dodds, a senior lecturer in child and family psychology at the University of Canterbury. Kia ora, kōrua, good morning.
Kia ora.
Willow, if I can start with you on this. I suppose, first of all, tell us what it is that Safeguarding Children, the organisation, does and how it came about.
So Safeguarding Children is a registered charity, and we started in Nelson in 2011 when three nurses, I'm one of them and I'm still a registered nurse now, and a detective from the Nelson Child Protection Team got together because we realised that there was an absolute lack of child protection training in our region for people working on the front line. What started as an idea up of a cup of coffee has resulted in as being one of the largest providers of child protection training in the country, much of which we do for free. We get no government funding at all.
So at the moment, what is the situation? What are the laws around reporting suspected child harm?
So at the moment in New Zealand, there is no mandatory reporting at all. So it means that people, and when I say people, I'm talking about people that work on the front lines, such as teachers, doctors, dentists, counsellors, social workers, those people that members of the public believe will do something and also are trained what to do and do it well. So there's no mandatory reporting at all. So people can notice that something's going on, but they don't have to complete a report of concern or pass that information on to a statutory agency. Now, in the Aranga Tamariki Act 1989, it says that anyone can report to a statutory social worker or belief or police if they've got a belief that a child or young person has been abused and neglected. But that isn't enough, because what tends to happen is people end up talking themselves out of it. They think that somebody else is going to do the job, or they don't recognise the signs of abuse and neglect. And they lose sight of the child, and they also lose sight of the terrible trauma that children face and young people face at the time and into adulthood as well. So it's very much at the moment whether somebody feels brave enough in many of the cases or to actually pass that information on. And that is why training is so important. So I'm actually for mandatory training, but it has to be supported by mandatory reporting, but it has to be supported by mandatory training.
What are some of these signs that you're talking about that people don't recognise?
So child abuse and neglect is complex, and some of the signs are very subtle, and very often it's not just one single event that's in front of you. We call it pieces of the jigsaw. So very often it's little indicators along the way that something isn't right for that child or young person, or maybe that the person who is working with them or volunteering with them isn't safe to be around that child or young person. And if that information isn't passed on, then it's very hard to get the true picture of what is actually happening for that child and young person, and what that risk is in play, what risk there is.
Okay, because I suppose a lot of people listening will think that the signs are perhaps very obvious, and I'm sure some of them are, but is it the grey areas, I suppose, where actually you may find quite a large number of children that are at risk of substantial harm?
So some of the signs are very obvious. You would imagine that a child presenting with black eye or two black eyes or bruising or welt mark, you would imagine that people would step up and report that, but that doesn't always happen. There are many things that actually prevent people from doing that, and particularly when they're working with children and young people. So, for example, they are fearful for making it worse for the child. They're fearful of their own safety, believe it or not. A lot of people that work on the front line also live and work within the community, and they fear for their own safety. The historical relationships with SIFs, as it was, and Oranga Tamariki, as it is now, actually put people off. So there are many, many reasons why people don't pass on the abuse, the signs of abuse, even though most people would imagine that they do. And there is research to say that members of the public are more likely to pass on their concerns about abuse and neglect than people working on the front line. Because very often, Susie, it is the culture of the organisation in which they work that actually makes a difference between them passing on the concerns or not. And I think the case of Malachi is a prime example of what happened there. They had all the evidence, they were writing about it, they were documenting, but a decision was made not to pass that information on. And that's where mandatory reporting really, really has a role.
Now, you mentioned that this can't go as a standalone measure, this mandatory reporting. It is about the training that goes hand in hand with it. So the
Absolutely.
current situation would have to change significantly if mandatory reporting became the way to go. Would you think that
Yes, it
that is
would.
okay? So, in what way would it have to change?
So at the moment, there is no mandatory training. So people are working on the front line in roles as teachers, doctors, nurses, social workers, counsellors, youth workers. They're working in roles where members of the public and other professionals believe that they have this training. So there are no undergraduate papers for social workers, for example, on child protection. So people are at the belief that somebody else will do something because that person knows more than what they do. So you might get a situation where a member of the public won't put a report of concern in because the child's going to school. So surely the teacher will have had the training and actually know what to do. And that isn't the case. So any training at the moment is voluntary, and we provide training for organisations. We provide a lot of free training. Most of our work is funded by a local philanthropic family in Nelson. And when we provide free training, then the courses sell out within a day. And most of those people, Susie, are frontline professionals working in roles where they should be mandated to have that training. And that training should be provided by the organisation that they work with, not by our local philanthropic family.
Sarah Whitcomb-Dodds, I'm going to bring you in at this point from the University of Canterbury, a senior lecturer in child and family psychology. You've previously written about your support for mandatory reporting of child abuse. What convinces you that this is the right way to go?
Well, ultimately, it's about how we value children in our society. So, my support for mandatory reporting, and it is a complex discussion that we should be having, but my support is based on the need to send a clear message to professionals and New Zealand society as a whole that we are collectively responsible and accountable for the safety of our children, and it's not just the role of Oranga Tamariki. It's not right that children are beaten, exposed to family violence, neglected, left without enough food or clothes or warmth. It's not right that children are exploited sexually, and professionals know about these things happening and do not report. So I just want to add, however, that there are risks in it if it is done without resourcing adequately supports for families. And so bringing in mandatory reporting while making cuts to social services, which are already under-resourced and massively stretched, will increase the risks that we would have a lot of children where there's an investigation without help given, and an increase in children coming into state care, and then a repeat of all the harms that have been done before. So it has to go hand in hand, more than training, but also the provision of early intervention and supports.
Because I suppose this is where it becomes extremely difficult to navigate. If children were going to be, for example, taken away from families while an investigation was underway, there is that danger very present, I guess, that they would be at risk of slipping through the cracks.
It's most notifications made to Oranga Tamariki do not result in a child coming into state care. It's by far that's an unlikely outcome in most cases, unless there's an urgent and serious risk to the child's safety, and in which case that is really important that steps are taken to preserve their safety. However, the idea that we shouldn't report physical or sexual abuse because we don't trust the organisation, like that's I guess a situation that we've come to in Aotearoa, that there is a history and a reason for that, but the Oranga Tamariki Act, the legislation, is written in a way that actually, ideally, whānau and families where child harm is occurring come to the attention of Oranga Tamariki earlier or another agency that holds that mandated role, because there's room for that within the Act, and then the preventative and intervention services can be available then up front. So I'm talking about access to housing, access to drug and alcohol treatment, mental health treatment, practical supports for families that are really struggling, that actually we need to bring those interventions and supports much earlier on in the piece rather than having that crisis-driven reactive responses where children are more likely to come into care.
So it seems that there would need to be a significant amount of investment, not just in training, as you say, also in other social services.
Yes.
And how would we safeguard professionals that Willow was talking about, you know, the doctors, the teachers, from experiencing a backlash within the community?
What do you mean in terms of...
Willow was saying that one of the reasons that people are hesitant now about reporting is because they may, if they report, they may then be a target themselves within the community because people will know where the report has come from. How do we safeguard those people?
Sure. So there are already some safeguards in place in terms of protecting reporters so people can make an anonymous notification. However, I acknowledge that in some situations families may be able to work out who made a notification. But I would argue, look, if you're scared of the family, think how that feels for the child in that family. Actually, we're the adults and we have a duty to protect all of the children in our society. So when we put our hands up and say, yes, I want to be a professional working on the front line with families, then we are signing up. We're already currently signing up to a child protection protocol, which is legislated under the Vulnerable Children's Act. This is a strengthening of that role of a professional in terms of making us more accountable for it, yes, but it's not changing our responsibilities substantially in that way.
What do other jurisdictions do? Are we a bit of an outlier on this?
Yeah, so I was just looking at this again. So about 80% of countries worldwide have mandated reporting of some form. And New Zealand is in the minority on this issue.
If I can come back to you on this, Willow, what is your sense of how this could be wrapped up? Because clearly there is the chance that this could snowball and become a situation where people would be frightened if they did report, but also frightened if they didn't report, right? You know, if it was mandatory, if you missed something, then people would be seen, as failing in their duty of care?
I agree with everything that Sarah has said, and the training that we provide covers all those areas that she's talked about, absolutely. And it isn't just, you know, what is a bruise, what does sexual abuse like? It's all the things that Sarah's talked about as well in training. And so, yeah, just ask me the question again.
Well, I'm
what
just
was that
thinking,
again?
What would it be like for the doctor or the teacher who's
right,
you know,
yeah,
what
okay,
happens if they
yeah.
if they have to you know, it's mandated that they have to report
yeah.
child abuse. What if they miss that? What does that mean for the child? But also, I suppose, what does that mean for the professional?
For me, it's about having open and honest conversations. I am very against people just putting a sneaky report of concern in. There are always opportunities to actually raise these concerns with the family and have conversations beforehand. So in actual fact, if the job is done properly, it shouldn't be that there is a surprise report of concern in that put in that blows people out of the water. And I think it's also about being open and honest in terms of the child protection policy that the organisation has. So the people that are actually signed up to the service understand that that organisation absolutely is accountable and absolutely will report any suspected child abuse and neglect. So that needs to go up front. And we always say when parents and carers sign up with any organisation, that should be made clear that that organisation takes working with children and sees it as such a privilege that they will not ignore child abuse and neglect, and they will pass that on.
Mm.
And if everybody understands that, then that is the beginning of a really good, honest relationship. Whereas what tends to happen, organisations have to have a child protection policy, like, for example, the Children's Act 2014, which we're trying desperately to get reviewed at the moment. Those policies, most of the people working at the place don't know where they are, and they definitely are not known to the parents and carers who are attending the setting, which is breaking legislation, because it says within the Children's Act that a child protection policy should be available on the internet. And that sets the scene. It lets people know what the intention of the organisation is. And it also, if it's on the internet, prevents people who absolutely should not be working with children, working with children. Mm. They know then that this is a child-safe organisation.
Sarah, to come back to you, a couple of quick points before we wrap up. How do we ensure cultural sensitivity across the various communities in Aotearoa in the midst of all this?
So what we know is that Māori are disproportionately represented within our child protection system, and that a substantial proportion of this is due to racism and bias in terms of at multiple steps within that system. And so I think there's been an argument around with mandatory reporting there being a risk of an increase in that disproportionality. I would say that the jury is out on that one in terms of evidence, that we don't know that that's the case, and it may actually be that when we have incredibly clear guidelines for professionals, that element of judgment being removed, that it's actually not their job to make a decision when actually they don't hold all the information, that actually they just have to pass on the information they do have, that actually it might reduce some of that disproportionality that's currently evident.
Mm. And if this was set up, if mandatory reporting did come in,
yes.
Who then pays for not just the extra training, but presumably also extra resources for social services?
Well, we should all pay. Child safety is just as important as police, ambulances, road safety. It's a public good, and it's in the public interest. There is actually
absolutely.
There is actually an economic argument for reducing child maltreatment in Aotearoa. That's incredibly important and powerful. But I would just say that actually the bottom line is about the moral argument in terms of us reducing the day-to-day suffering of our children in Aotearoa.
Mm. Ngā mihi nui. Thank you both very much for your time. Interesting discussion. Sarah Whitcomb-Dodds there, a senior lecturer in child and family psychology at the University of Canterbury. And we were also speaking with Willow Duffy, chief executive of Safeguarding Children.